Blog Talk Radio. Is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we welcome back author, writer, screenwriter, playwright, director, Greg Oppenheimer. He has several plays that he's done, but his last play was I Love Lucy, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Sitcom, which was done both as a stage play and a radio play. His newest show is called The Private Lives of Ethel and Albert. It's going to be on his YouTube channel on December 20th. Greg's going to tell you all about it. Here's Greg.
Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
How are you doing? How are you surviving during all this pandemonium of the pandemic?
I've been doing some writing and I'm working on, I finally got so stir crazy and missing directing radio theater that I decided to see if there's some way I could do it remotely with all the people that I've been working with before. And so I've launching a new series of online radio theater programs.
That's cool. So you're doing, is it still about Lucy or is it about other things? This is a new concept.
Well, my direction has never been exclusively Lucy. I've been directing radio plays for 20 years and a whole range of things. Everything I did, you know, the Maltese Falcon and The Third Man and all, things like that as well. Burns and Allen, Jack Benny. So and My Favorite Husband, Lucy stuff. I tend towards comedy, but right range of things. But I love the medium of radio. And the nice thing about radio recreations is you have the theater of the imagination. Because you're imagining things in your mind's eye, and the guy's doing sound effects, but you can actually see the actors at the same time. So you're sort of half in your imagination and half watching the actors do the performance. And it occurred to me that I could do that with some Zoom-like production on online, and so that's what I'm working on. I don't like what? Zoom enough. Zoom has problems to do it because Zoom is for meetings. And if two people talk at the same time on Zoom, two actors like overlapping or whatever, the software interprets that as a problem that it has to solve. So I found another a program called StreamYard, which is more suited for what I'm doing. It's going very well.
What is it the same
kind of principle? Yeah, StreamYard is limited to 10 participants, but you don't have to allow all your audience doesn't have to go on to StreamYard. Your audience can watch it on YouTube Live or something. Because I don't need to have to deal with everybody who comes to watch it as being a participant in my meeting, so. It works fine. You can stream to Facebook Live and YouTube Live at the same time. But I'm going to do it on YouTube Premiere is my first one and subsequent ones. One I'm doing is called Ethel and Albert, which is a sitcom that was by a woman named Peg Lynch, who was a genius. She practically invented the sitcom. She wrote this sitcom and others. She wrote 11,000. Almost 11,000 radio and TV scripts, comedy scripts over her career. I met her when I was six because she was on one of my dad's TV shows, General Motors 50th Anniversary Special. And then I met her again in like 2007 at one of the old time radio conventions, and we just, you know, it was like we'd been 2 days since last time. It was sort of amazing because I was 6 years old.
That's cool.
But it's yeah. So I have the first show I'm doing
is
on December
10th. Do I know
her show? It was called Ethel and the Private Lives of Ethel and Albert was the radio show, and that was also a sketch on the Kate Smith program, which was an early TV show done live, and then they became a TV series called The Couple Next Door, and she had another one I can't recall, there was fairly early stuff, so it was probably before you would, it was all in New York. They were doing all these live programs, but it's great stuff. It's not set up punchline laugh, set up punchline laugh. It's more people on her shows talk the way real people do, like a married couple. You know, people will repeat themselves a lot in real life, but you never see that on a sitcom because, you know, everybody's very witty and the repartee is very fast paced. But you watch that, it sounds like real married couples. So, and it's interesting. You have to do it like a the problem I'm finding, but I'm finding solutions around it. If I'm doing a sitcom, I don't have an audience. There's no laughter. And I'm used to doing things with an audience reaction. So you have to treat it like a Howard Hawks movie, like His Girl Friday or something, where there's just no space in between. There's not an instant of dead air, so there's not waiting for the laugh. It's just go. If they're going to laugh, they're going to laugh over the next thing the character's saying. So it has to be very fast paced. But it's a lot of fun.
So, are you going to use canned laughter as well, or is it just going to be
No. I'm relying on the pacing to get around that. I'm planning it. That this one is Ethel and Albert's. It's a sitcom. I think it works pretty well because there's really no daylight in between. You know, there's not a second in between when they're talking to each other. And the next one I'm planning is The Lives of Harry Lime, which is a drama, but it's got a lot of comedy in it, based on the movie The Third Man, Orson Welles' film noir. But believe it or not, he turned that into a radio show that was a lot of comedy. It's a prequel, and the Harry Lime character is a nicer guy than in the movie. We're going to use the same. Yeah,
movie.
It was one of my favorite radio show ever, and we're going to rely on the same pacing thing. Haven't done it yet, but and I have a guy, a friend, Edward French, who's interestingly he's a Oscar-nominated, Emmy Award-winning freelance makeup artist. But I just happened to find him; he does a perfect Orson Welles voice. And then we've got the two surviving members of the Firesign Theater comedy troupe. Phil Proctor and David Osman are going to be in it as well, and it should be great. And then the one after that I'm planning is the Jack Benny program. I won't tell you who's going to be in that, but I've got some. It's Burns and Allen with Jack Benny as a guest, so I've got a really good George Burns impersonator and a really good Jack Benny impersonator, and Gracie Allen as well. So that should be a lot of fun. But that's going
to
be most challenging because that's what?
I used to watch those reruns. The Jack Benny show reruns and the George and Gracie reruns. They used to have them on I grew up in LA. It was one of the independent stations before Super Cable and all that. And it was like watching early Bewitched and stuff like that. I didn't really realize how old it was until I got a little older. My parents explained it to me. Like I Love Lucy.
It was done live. It was before Lucy. They may have filmed it later. I really don't recall. But it was done the way they thought they were going to do I Love Lucy. Lucy and Desi wanted to do it at CBS Columbia Square on Sunset in Hollywood in Studio A, just the way George Burns and Gracie Allen did their show. And then because there were, you couldn't broadcast nationwide at the time, they would take a picture off the TV screen, which was called a kinescope, film that, and then develop that film, and then a week or two later they would send it to the East Coast, and the East Coast would see the crappy film that's taken off of a TV screen. If you've ever seen a film off of a TV screen, you see it's not very good. And that's the way they thought they were going to do it, until the sponsor said, no way. 85% of the audience is in New York. We're not going to have them watching a crappy picture and then just have the people in L.A. see it well. So, but that's why if you watch the production values on, I mean, the comedy is wonderful, but the production values on Burns and Allen is not very good, because they just, you know, put up a flimsy set for that show, and then right after they finish, they take it down. Whereas they had permanent sets for I Love Lucy.
Yeah. I always thought it was interesting, because before I ever saw it, I used to watch the George Burns specials when I was a little kid. He used to have like a Christmas show, like Jack Benny did too. So those are the shows I saw. And then when they started showing the reruns with Gracie, I was really excited because he was always referring to Gracie. I had only seen her in one movie with Fred Astaire called Damsel in Distress. So I had never seen her, and it was really cool to be actually able to watch the episodes. I wasn't that discerning about the production value at that age. I think it was about 12 or 13.
Well, if the comedy's good enough, you don't even notice. You know, it's just who's paying attention to that stuff. But it's nice to have that good too. My favorite George Burns line was, somebody asked him once, Mr. Burns, what's the secret to making it in Hollywood? And he said, sincerity. If you can fake that, you've got it made.
Yeah. My dad loved to quote that. He thought it was one of the funniest lines he ever heard, too.
Yeah.
But it's true, though, and especially in Los Angeles. I grew up there. I know. If you can fake that, you can fake anything.
Right.
So you're going to be doing Jack Benny visiting George and Gracie, because they were neighbors. For the people who don't know that are listening, in the show, I don't know if in reality, but in the show, Jack Benny lived next to George and Gracie.
Yeah, in reality, he lived next to Lucy and Desi. But
yeah, that I knew. But yeah. And Jimmy Stewart on the other side, is that right?
Or Ronald Coleman, I thought. Of course, that was on the show. I don't know if he really did.
Okay. Because I remember Jack Benny. I remember Jimmy talking about it, because he was on Johnny Carson, and they were asking him, and he said he was next, it was either a couple houses down or next door to Lucy. And that he grew vegetables. He retired and became sort of a gentleman farmer. And he would bring vegetables to her house. And one day she had a new maid, and she made him come around the back for delivery. The whole audience thought it was funny. It was really hilarious. And Johnny goes, so you were able to give the veggies? And he goes, oh yeah, she got them. She loved them. She thought it was hilarious. He said, I was just wearing jeans and a work shirt and with my veggies and my dog.
When my dad left I Love Lucy in 1956 to go to NBC, Lucy and Desi threw him a farewell party at their house in Beverly Hills. And they had a tent in the backyard, and it was a lot of people, everybody who worked on the show. And they had entertainment and everything. It was pretty loud. And Jack Benny, who wasn't invited because he had nothing to do with the show, but he heard all the noise. He just wandered in. He wanted to see what's going on. So you have pictures of him, you know, coming in and, you know, talking to my dad and Lucy and Desi. And he still had his overcoat on. I guess he had just gotten home from someplace and was wondering what the ruckus was.
Oh, that's so funny. No, from what I understand, I mean, a lot of my knowledge is from interviews with people and, you know, like Foundation is great to get interview information of the real people. And but Jack was a really nice guy. He was the complete opposite of his image that he projected in the show.
Oh, sure. Yeah, he was, in fact, it's interesting, you know, because he was one of the most generous people around. And the show that we're going to do is How Jack Benny Became a Cheapskate.
Oh, that's cute. Oh. My favorite, I think it was the Lucy show. She was, Jack was a guest. Well, it's not my, it was one of my top favorites. Another, I have several of them from each season. But on the Lucy show, he came, she wanted him to get his account, Jack's account, and so she made a new thing for him at the bank, like his, he had a lion, so she had alligators and quicksand and the...
Yeah.
Did you ever see that one?
No, but I've seen all this stuff in with his vault. Similar stuff with his vault on his show.
Yeah, he had, on his show he had tigers and a hit team that came after you that came out from a wall. But of course, the most famous go ahead.
My dad worked on his show in 1937, before he had Lucky Strike as a sponsor. Jell-O was a sponsor. And so Young and Rubicam was the ad agency because they represented Jell-O, General Foods. And there was a guy named Al Boasberg who was a wild gag line guy who had written for Benny since vaudeville. And he would just come in on Saturdays and help him punch up the script. And he finally passed away. And my dad was 23. Somebody told Jack Benny that he was a, you know, talented young comedy writer. And so they hired him. My dad said they moved the salary, you know, the decimal point over a couple of points. My dad would come in on Saturday after they'd written the script. He'd just sit around the table as they would read through the script at Benny's house, and anything funny line he would come up with, he'd just say. He didn't have to figure out a situation or premise or characters or anything. He just, whatever came to his head. He said it was the easiest job he ever had.
That is so cool.
And yeah.
Well,
and Benny was the greatest audience.
They hit great comedy writers, Jack.
I couldn't hear what you said. I'm sorry.
I said Jack had great comedy writers all his life. I mean.
Yes. He also had the greatest timing of anybody. If you listen to a Jack Benny show, it's probably true of the TV show as well. Whenever somebody has a funny line, whoever it is, whether it's Benny or somebody else, the next line is almost always Jack Benny's, because he could time how long to let the audience laugh before coming in with the next line better than anybody. He knew that, so he took that job on himself.
The famous one, and I know it was on radio, and I know that they redid it because I have a CD of his radio shows, but I know they also did it for a TV show for Jack.
What's that?
And the one I love is Your Money or Your Life with Mel Blanc.
Oh yeah.
Realize Bugs Bunny worked for Jack Benny.
the longest laugh they ever had was Jack had, because of what I said about timing the laughs and everything, he had very strict control. It wasn't ad libs or improv or anything. It was just everybody was following the script exactly. And so there were no surprises on that show. And so the one, this is the longest laugh ever. Don Wilson introduced him at the beginning, and he said he was supposed to make some reference to Drew Pearson, who was a celebrity at the time. He said Drew Pearson. and so Benny kidded him mercilessly about it for a few seconds, and then when they finished, they went on with the show. So one of the writers ran over to Frank Nelson who was in a later scene and wrote something on his script that, you know, just to surprise Benny with. And so Frank Nelson played the floor walker, and he'd always, you know, Benny would say, are you the floor walker? And he says, well, what do I look like? Little Bo Peep or something. It's some snide, you know, comeback. So when he gets to Frank Nelson's line, he says, are you the floor walker? And the line they'd written in Frank Nelson's script, which he read back, was, what do I look like, Drew Pearson? And Benny was not expecting that. He fell on the floor laughing for about a minute. It was like one of the longest. And everybody just, the audience just went wild.
Yeah, George Burns, I think it was an interview with Phil Donahue, said that Jack was the greatest audience ever. If he thought something was funny, he would fall down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was a challenge to George Burns, to get him to do that, and he did it frequently. And my dad said he was such a great audience, but also a great judge of material. You know, sometimes Dad would come up with a line, and he would fall on the floor laughing. And so that's the greatest line I've ever heard. Too bad we can't use it. You know, you have some reason why it doesn't quite fit into the show or the character or something, but, you know, he wouldn't just throw something in because it's funny, as some shows do.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess it was all those years in vaudeville that made him discriminating. He just knew exactly what worked and what didn't.
Well, yeah, well, but a lot of other people had a lot of years in vaudeville, and he was a better judge than they were. My dad... Of course, some people weren't comedians at all. My dad wrote on the Rudy Valley program, and Rudy Valley was a very popular singer, and it was a comedy program, but he was not a comedian. And once he suddenly ad-libbed, it wasn't exactly, he threw in the punchline from a joke the previous week. And he thought it would get a laugh. He couldn't understand why people didn't laugh at it because they laughed at that line last week. None of the setup or anything, the joke was there, just the punchline. That's how little he understood the crack comedy. He came out after the show, I don't understand it. They laughed hysterically when I said that last week.
I don't think he was funny naturally. I'm not really sure.
Rudy Valley? Oh, he was. He did some very funny movies. How to Succeed, he was good in, and Palm Beach Story. Yeah, but no, he had no concept of what he was doing in terms of comedy.
Yeah, Bachelor and Bob. What? With Cary Grant. Did you ever see it?
Which movie was that?
Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer.
Oh yes, with
Cary Grant, Malloy, Shirley Temple, and Rudy Valley.
Shirley Temple. Yeah, he was good in that. Yes, but he was reading the lines, you know. That's a testament to the director. Palm Beach Story, of course, was, I've forgotten
was
the name
drama.
Of the director.
I remember right? That was a drama, Palm Beach Story.
No, it was a comedy, Claudette Colbert. It was Preston Sturges, one of the greatest comedy directors ever.
Okay, I'm mixing it up with another movie. I thought it was a different
movie.
There's another movie. similar title, and that's a drama. So, and it has different actors.
Okay. No, this is by the writer-director of Lady Eve, which is one of my favorite movies ever.
I love that movie.
That's, yeah. Henry Fonda and Barbara Stanwyck and Charles Coburn.
I love Great. Charles Coburn. I don't think Charles Coburn could ever do something wrong. He was just, he was like the perfect comedic actor.
Him and Cuddle Zuckel.
Oh, I
him?
Loved him too. Yes. Oh, he was so funny.
Particularly in he's the fat waiter in Casablanca.
Uh-huh. And
oh,
he was in
Christmas
in Connecticut. He was in several of the Doris Day movies back in the day.
Yes. Yeah. My favorite thing in Casablanca is Cuddle Zuckel's expression when the couple who's they're German but they're fleeing to America they insist on speaking English because they're learning the language and then the husband or the wife says to the other, darling, what watch? And the other one says, nein watch. Looks at his watch, says, nein watch. It says, such watch.
I remember. I read Doris Day's autobiography, and one of the things in it that she said that I thought was so funny was that she always laughed about Cuddles at makeup time because he didn't like the inside of his nose or behind his ears to be made up.
Mm-hmm.
So every morning, the makeup person and him would be running around because he'd be running from because he didn't want them to put the makeup on there.
I can't imagine him running. He
was
rather large.
She said it was hilarious because it was every morning. She said he would hide behind me. He'd hide behind Gordon McRae, other people. Anything to get away from him. I thought it was adorable.
I'm sure the
makeup lady didn't. But yeah, it's in her. It was because he was in several movies with her, and she just adored. I think he was in her TV series too. A couple of guest spots.
Cuddles is such a great name.
I know. Well, he was cuddly. It makes sense to me. As soon as I saw
yes.
it, I said, yeah.
Of course.
He was like a teddy bear.
There's these great old character actors that you see in all these movies, like Lionel Stander.
Mm-hmm.
With a real deep, with a gravelly
voice. People don't realize what a career he had before Heart to Heart. I mean, he had an incredibly long distinguished career before he ever played Max.
Right. You know what I've often thought it was amazing is this isn't exactly character actors, but a lot of people are familiar with cartoons and the cartoon voices, and they don't realize, they have no idea that most of the familiar cartoon voices is Dawes Butler doing an impression of some old movie actor. Like the toucan for Fruit Loops. That's Dawes Butler doing an impression of Ronald Coleman. Snagglepuss.
That makes sense. Okay.
He's doing an impression of Bert Lahr from the Wizard of Oz, and Captain Crunch is an impression of an old comedian named Charlie Butterworth that nobody remembers. But everybody knows his voice because it's Captain Crunch.
That is so funny. No, I didn't know that one. Hans Conried, Mel Blanc. Mel Blanc is Bugs Bunny. I mean, I got that immediately when I was watching the Jack Benny show. I said, when I first saw the Jack Benny show and I heard him talking, I go, Yeah, I was a little girl. I said, he related to Bugs Bunny.
Those are about the two of the only two people that from Hollywood that my dad was socialized with when he wasn't working, and it was Hans Conried and Mel Blanc, very good friends of the family. They were really funny people.
I had such respect, and I mean, Harry Morgan did a lot, but I think Hans Conried beat him in being in everything, TV, movies, everything.
And Hans Conried was, when he was on radio, he was on a million radio shows, but he was also the warm-up comic at CBS, Studio A for a lot of radio shows like Silver Theater and stuff. He was really a wonderful guy. We went to Disneyland when I was a kid. We went to Disneyland on my birthday every year, first 5 or 6 years with the Conrieds. And we were in line for the Matterhorn, and somebody came over with an autograph book, and he was, of course, used to that, and the guy came up to him and said, "Excuse me, are you Conrad Nagel?" And his face fell.
Really mix up Hans Conried with anyone else. He had a very distinctive look.
Right. I remember I was excited to meet him because Peter Pan. He was Captain Hook, and I met him, and I met Cyril Richard, who was the Mary Martin TV version. Peter Pan was Captain Hook from that, and that was a big thrill for me.
I actually saw Hans once. I think he did a voiceover. It was a Disney movie that he did one of the voiceovers for. I can't remember which one. But he
Cyril Richard
in line with
Hans Conried.
Huh?
Hans Conried?
Hans Conried. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
he's a
And he was
lots
in line for the movie with us.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when by then I was about 9 or 10, and I knew that they could go different. They didn't have to wait in line. And I was really surprised. And I said to my dad, I go, "Isn't that Mr. Conry?" I was very polite. And Daddy said, "Yeah." And I go, "Can I go over there and say hi?" Because that's all I did. I didn't ask for an autograph or anything, which now I kick myself for. And he goes, "Yeah, just be polite." So I went over and I said, I was a little girl. I was an idiot. I said, "Hi, Mr. Conried, I like your movies." And he goes, "Well, thank you. I hope you like this one." And I go, "I will. I hope." And then I ran and I hid my face in my dad's chest. I was brave enough to go over, but I was an idiot.
I used to watch. Did you ever see Fractured Flickers?
No.
He had a TV show with it. He had a TV show where they would show old movies with I can't recall what they did. I think they either narrated it or put different dialogue on the old movies. Sort of like What's Up, Tiger Lily, the Woody Allen movie.
Oh.
You've seen that, haven't you? You ever seen that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
which he did not direct. Believe it or not, it was his idea, but he didn't direct it. They took, or he was directing it, but they took the edit away from him, which is why the Love and Spoonful has a musical number in the middle because the studio thought people would get bored.
I had friends of the family who were editors and husband and wife, and they used to say that if you watch a movie and it should have been great and it flopped, it was because there was a studio edit that went against what the director wanted. He actually, his name was Fowler, Gene Fowler, Jr.
Mm.
And he actually did an interview for me. I met him when I was like 16, but he was really nice and he did an interview for me when I was in college. And that was one of the things he said. He goes, if it's an editor who's working for directly for the director, it will be correct. If it's an editor who's working for the studio, 9 times out of 10, they're just doing what they're told.
Okay. Except occasionally, when the director has a wrong concept or is too self-indulgent and lets the thing run for 3.5 hours or something.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But it's interesting. It's how if something is edited right and something is edited wrong, you can really see it in the movie. You don't realize how much an edit can change a film until you actually watch what the process does. They're so important.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, yes. Everything up to then is to give the editor what the materials he needs to assemble a good movie, but you got to have someone who really knows what they're doing.
Steven Spielberg says his editor saved his, you know what, more times than he could count.
Absolutely. It's amazing.
I can't remember her name.
It's amazing how many people it takes to... most people don't even think about it. They just know the people they're seeing on the screen. And maybe they know the director's name if they're famous enough. But even the writers, it all starts with a blank page. If there's nothing on the page,
writers
you're not going to do a good...
Writers are the most important thing. Because if you don't write it, there's no movie. There's nothing for the director to direct, nothing for the actors to do, nothing for the wardrobe and special effects. It all comes from the piece of paper or now computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
They should have a lot more respect than they do.
Yeah, they do, and they have more respect on Broadway, but or on the stage. But they have the most respect.
On Broadway, the writer is king, right? They're the ones who really run shows on Broadway. They're collaborative with the director, but it's the writer's baby.
I think the director has more, and the producers have more sway than that. But the writer is collaborating with them the whole time. The hierarchy is like in publishing, the writer has pretty much sway because there's nothing but the writing. It's the way it's presented, and the copy editors and the editors, the publisher, but. It's just the writer. He's not competing with the director and the actors and everything. It's just the writer. Then the stage, he's still pretty damn important. And then you get to movies, and he's doesn't get the credit he deserves. And then you get to TV, and it's like, don't let them on the set.
Which makes no sense.
Unless they're also the producer and the creator, and they're there for that and running the show.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, my dad was the first showrunner.
A lot of them become that. Maybe because
my
they have more control of their career that way.
My dad was the first showrunner, really, because he was a writer, producer, creator of the show, and he was also in charge of it. And
he created so many things when he did I Love Lucy. It's just amazing between him and your dad. That didn't exist before they started doing that show.
Yeah, they had the advantage of being the first. And every time they did something, they would do some old vaudeville routine, and that was the first time I'd ever been on TV. The first process shot, you're in a car and you're seeing a screen behind them showing the road behind. That's the first time that was ever done on TV. On Isle of Lucy. A lot of firsts.
Desi said on an interview that the most expensive thing they ever did was the shtick with the ship taking them to Europe and Lucy missing it and the helicopter bringing her down. He said that was the most expensive thing they ever did on the show.
Yeah, but the way they were able to afford that was they got it was a product placement deal with the cruise line.
Ah, that makes sense.
So, because it was a real cruise line and a real ship and everything, and they were, yeah. That had quite a cast. Jack Albertson was in that one. And other people. He played the guy on shore, told him to tug it, to you know hurry because the next boat was going, the launch going out to meet the boat, and then they finally had to bring it.
He looked familiar.
Jack Albertson.
I never could figure it out who it was. The pilot on the helicopter.
Oh yeah, I don't know who he was. But yeah, he was a character actor. Was in a bunch of things. Yeah, I have his name somewhere, but it's not like he starred in a series or anything.
Okay. He just looked really familiar to me, and I looked up the stuff that they show on IMDb.
DB.
I mean, other than like Lucy and some of the other Desi Lu productions, I don't really recognize his work.
I'm having a little dispute with IMDb. There was the I Love Lucy movie, which was they took three episodes of I Love Lucy and cut them together. Did a little bit of extra, you know, connective tissue, shots of a couple of new scenes, and made it into a movie. This is in 1953, and then they showed it at a movie theater in Bakersfield, and it went over very well. But it's interesting, the kids, they had to figure out, what do we do with all the audience laughter? You don't have that on a movie screen. So they, one of the framing device was, it starts with people going to watch a filming of an episode of I Love Lucy, and they show the people in line, and they show going in and going to the bleachers and the director's booth and the sets and the cameras and everything, and they have Desi comes out and explains this is the way we make a TV show, and then it starts, and then you're watching the show, and it's three shows together, but so that it seems natural to have the audience laughter because it started with showing you the audience, and but it worked, but then they just made a deal at about the same time with excuse me. With MGM to do the long trailer. It was their first movie together, and MGM said, saw that movie and said, "It's very nice, but we don't want a competing movie out there. We want to have the only movie with the two of you. So put that on the shelf, and we don't want it to ever see the light of day." So it didn't for many, many years. Well, we released it on DVD, and so it's on IMDb because it did play in a theater. But when I produced the DVDs, I put it out. So I'm looking, and my dad's given third billing as a writer on IMDb. On the on-screen credits, it said story and screenplay by Jess Oppenheimer, Madeline Pugh, and Bob Carroll Jr.
Mm-hmm.
So they let you upload photos. Stills from movies, so I uploaded photos of the credits, of all the credits, you know, the screens, and you can director and writers and everything, and I submitted a change to have the writer order be the way it is on screen, and they rejected it. They rejected it because it was not verifiable. I hadn't been able to verify my information. But the weird thing is you go to that page and the first thing you see is a picture at the top that has my name, my dad's name. You know, the writer's screen, it shows him at the top billing, and then you go down a few lines and you see he's given third billing in the text. It's really strange. I probably find that more interesting than anybody listening. But
doesn't Lucy Arnaz have all of the films? Can't she show it to them that this is correct and it is verifiable?
they don't need to look at the films. If you go to the page, it says the name of the movie, and then right under that is the photo that I uploaded, which is the screen credit, a still of the screen that shows the writer's credits. Says story and screenplay by Jess Oppenheimer, Madeline Pugh, Bob Carroll Jr. So you see that in bigger letters before you get to the incorrect order that they typed in.
Oh, I see. I misunderstood. Okay, that's stupid.
So I referred them to their own page for verification.
Have they fixed it?
No. But that's okay. First thing people see on the page is my dad giving first credit as a writer, so that's fine. I fixed it myself.
Well, that's all you can do. I mean, that's really stupid,
yeah.
Though. They should fix it. It's not that big a deal.
IMDb is very frustrating to deal with. There's Peg Lynch, who wrote Ethel and Albert, the show that I'm doing in December 20. And by the way, it's if people want to see that, they should just go to my YouTube channel. Just search Greg Oppenheimer with two G's and two P's under YouTube, and it'll be the first thing there. But Peg Lynch was on, as I said, when I met her in 1957, she was on the General Motors 50th anniversary special. And so I went to see if she had credit for that, and they put the wrong Peg Lynch on the cast list for that. There's somebody else whose real name was Peg Lynch, and his stage name was something else. She never acted as Peg Lynch, but they put her there, and I could not get them to fix that. So finally I got them to add the real Peg Lynch. So now supposedly there's two different people named Peg Lynch who played Peg Lynch on this show. Makes no sense. So anyway,
All right. That's
IMDb.
Hi. We're coming to the end. Could you give your website?
My website for my book is lucynet.com, but the YouTube channel is...
Channel.
For my show, if people want to go to my show, they should go to my YouTube channel and subscribe, and they'll get a notice from YouTube 30 minutes before each of, not just this one, but each of the subsequent ones. And it's Greg Oppenheimer. Just search that under YouTube, and you'll come to my channel. And the first one's called Ethel and Albert. And so subscribe, and you'll get a notice. And to get my play, I Love Lucy, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Sitcom, you can either look it up on Amazon, or you can look it or me up on latw.org, the two places that it's downloads are for sale for a couple of dollars. I think $4.99.
Really, by the way, I loved it.
Yeah, that was so much
I
fun.
Love,
it stars Sarah Drew from Grey's Anatomy as Lucy, and Oscar Nunez from The Office as Desi, and they just did a marvelous job.
It was great. I loved it. It was wonderful.
BBC?
And
the BBC did a production of that, by the way.
Did they?
Yeah, with Anne Hesh as Lucy. Anne Hesh as Lucy, Wilmer Valderrama as Desi, Stacy Keach as Bill Frawley, and Alfred Molina as Harry Ackerman. And it aired in the UK. It was
Stacy Keach would be a great William Frawley because he has that same facial feature. Very close.
Except it was radio.
Was his voice good? I mean, I can see him do it, but I don't know.
Yeah.
How's his voice?
I just saw Stacy Keach early in January, I think, on the stage as Frankenstein. He played the monster.
Ooh, cool.
It was very cool. Was
great
a good
actor.
Show.
So we're coming to the end. I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show.
My pleasure.
Do you have any social media in case anybody wants to say hi?
I couldn't. Do I have any what?
Social media.
Social media?
Facebook.
I'm on Facebook. if you want, you know, if they want to say hi, they can go to my YouTube channel and leave a comment, you know, I can get back to them that way.
Okay, great. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.